This is Ozarks at Large for Wednesday, December 28th, 2011. I'm Christina Thomas.
I'm Kyle Kellums.
Jacqueline Froelich.
I'm Katie Henriksen.
I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
And I'm Mithi Agnihotri Matholkar.
And today, as we're doing all this week, reviewing some of our favorite stories from 2011 on Ozarks at Large. This is the first full year of The Daily Show. Mm-hmm. So what's 6 times 52? That's how many shows we did this year.
A lot.
12. More than 300.
312.
312.
Yes, 312.
Thank you, math girl.
Well, since you are Johnny on the spot with the math, if he will, we'll start with a story that you did this year, an interview you did that was about Fayetteville history.
It was. This book had just come out about the history of Fayetteville, a pictorial history of Fayetteville, and the authors, in fact, the editors, Charles Allison and Ellen Compton, were in this very studio. And it was so interesting, you know, how the process of picking out these photographs from a huge database of photographs collected from all over the place, and how they picked out these particular photographs, and just looking at, you know, the photo of Wilson Park having a pond there instead.
Yeah.
It was great. It was great. And I still have that book, and it's one of my favorite books.
I think for us, the first step came when Ellen was contacted by somebody from the publishing company that did the printing of the book, mm-hmm. Arcadia Publishing. They were looking for somebody to do a book about Fayetteville history, pictorial history, and somehow got in touch with Ellen, and Ellen eventually got in touch with me. So that was sort of the first step.
Well, Rogers and Bentonville both have books done by Arcadia Press. Gabe Land, the director at Rogers Historical, got in touch with me, and so I told Charlie that if he would write it, I would do most of the work on getting the pictures.
Okay, so you kind of split out the responsibilities a little bit.
Yes, we did.
Yeah. Ellen went looking for photos. We sort of had two major collections in mind when we started. Shiloh Museum of Ozark History up at Springdale has the Washington County Historical Society's collection of photographs. The Society collected photographs from its beginning in 1951 through sometime in the 1990s. And so we wanted to look at that collection. And then Ellen works at Special Collections, and of course, so we wanted to go through Special Collections and see what was there. We knew that William Campbell, who had written Fayetteville's first narrative history of Fayetteville, he had collected photos as well, and most of those were in Special Collections. So we sort of tackled those two big collections to look at photos.
In Special Collections, we have the Lemke papers. Walter Lemke was the founder of the Washington County Historical Society. There were a lot of pictures in his collection. And William Campbell, who wrote 100 Years of Fayetteville in 1929, which was the first illustrated history, the first history, really, of Fayetteville. And then the McElroy Bank had given us their collection, and we just had numerous other collections from which to pull pictures.
So how many pictures did you look at for this book?
Ellen and I were just talking about how many pictures we looked at, and just the Historical Society's collection at Shiloh is 5,000 images above that. And now, a lot of those are not Fayetteville. The Historical Society collected from across the county. But to figure out which ones were Fayetteville, we had to go through all of them, and the most fun and most difficult part of the job was looking through all the photos and then trying to figure out how to cull the ones that we wanted to keep, and that was frustrating at times, because you'd see two photos that were just wonderful, but you knew only one of them was going to represent that sort of part of Fayetteville's history.
Did you ever feel constrained by some sort of word limit, or in just knowing that you had to write captions and not paragraphs and paragraphs on the history of the images?
I felt at pains to get what I wanted to say into just captions rather than having some exposition space. But my training is as a journalist, and I remember at some point Roy Reed talking about the captions in National Geographic magazine. How if you looked at them and tried to look at the caption and pull any word out, You just couldn't do it. Every word was written into those captions for a reason, to tell the reader something they don't know that they can't see from the photo, but that you would want them to know. And so, at least in my mind, I tried to think of our captions the same way. What is obvious in the photo that I don't need to write? What can people not see in the photo and need to write? So that's sort of what guided me on trying to write. But Arcadia, I think they had an 8,000-word limit for the whole book. So that meant if I added a couple words on this caption, I had to take a couple out on this caption. And that was very difficult, yeah.
That's a very tight word limit.
And don't you think figuring out dates was one of the most challenging, particularly on those old buildings, 19th-century buildings?
Yeah, some of the dates when the Historical Society was collecting the photographs, they would, of course, try to get a date from the person who was donating it. Do you remember when this happened? Do you know that? And some of that information has made it to Shiloh, and over the years, Shiloh has updated some of the photographs and added information as they found it. But a lot of times, the information on the cut line was just not minimal because they just had never had anybody go look for detailed information about them. Mm-hmm.
How did you go about that? How did you finally find these dates and include them in the book?
Automobiles.
Yeah. Automobiles helped. I would get a scan of a photo from Shiloh Museum, and if it had a photo in it, the first thing I did was blow the photo up until I could see the license plate or the make of the car. I'm not very good with knowing exact years on cars, but I could usually get some sense of, you know, whether it was the early 40s or the 30s or 20s by how old the car was. Some of going through the photos that we didn't use helped a lot because some of them would be dated, have a date assigned to them, and if you could see a building in one of those photos and correlate it to a photo that you're trying to find information out, sometimes it was meant tracking down, going to the Fayetteville Library and going through a lot of their archival materials, and especially old telephone books, old directories. Those help you figure out when a business was operating.
And sometimes it helped to know date a building came down, and then you'd start working back from that.
And the other thing that Marie DeMarucas up at Shiloh, her team has also gotten very good at looking at clothing, what somebody is wearing, and being able to say, okay, those puffy sleeves didn't come in until here, and nobody wore them after here. So they've gotten very good at pegging pictures by styles, clothing styles, and like I said, automobile styles.
How much time did it take for you guys to complete this book?
Probably about a year from the time that we sort of agreed to do it to when we had to turn over our materials to them. And it's taken another 4 or 5 months for them to get it printed and, you know, double check with us on spellings and typos and that sort of stuff. And they were very good at catching us on those things and helping us get the book in shipshape form.
You guys are experts. And you know a lot about Fayetteville and its history, but was there any piece of information or pieces of information that you came across and you were like, I had no idea?
Several times. Maybe one of the most surprising set of pictures, I think we've got three of them, are of the Veterans Administration Hospital grounds and, you know, when that was all built. And to see that so totally bare and how they planned that and laid that out.
Yeah, it's
just the look of it.
The hilltop on which the Veterans Hospital is on, it used to be called Watermelon Hill, and the aerial photographs of it show that it was just almost just a big, huge, long field at the brow of the hill. So all of the trees, if you're driving by Veterans now, all the big, beautiful trees that circle the oval driveway, all of those have grown since that time, and that's very often the biggest changes you can see in photos, where either there was nothing in the way of vegetation and things have grown up since then, or in other cases where there was lots of vegetation that's gone now.
And one of those examples is College Avenue.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. From the turn of the 20th century, College Avenue was very much a residential street. A few churches along it, and at the turn of the century, the new courthouse was built. So it began at that point changing from residential to more commercial. And it was a long, slow process, but it started sort of where the East Center Street and Mountain Street intersect and eventually made its way north as other buildings of a more commercial nature took hold. Part of it was driven by automobiles. Gas stations started opening and wiping out whatever residential home had been at that site. And rather than having trees in front of their business, they wanted an easy driveway. And and now Fayetteville, of course, is in that same area, has put in a median and started adding trees again.
Well, I'd like to do a footnote and credit Renee Diaz, who is an architect, but he specialized in historic properties. And he did a paper about Washington or about College Avenue when he was here on the faculty. He was able to trace a lot of it to the coming of electricity, because as they built, as the highway became, as 71 became the main highway, they were building lines, electrical lines, all down the street and putting poles into the trees and cutting the trees to make way for lighting the street. And that was just, you know, was what was done. It was progress. And that, he believed, was a big part of the loss of the trees.
One picture that fascinated me the most was there was a pond in Wilson Park.
Oh, mm-hmm.
I'm a recent transplant to Fayetteville, so of course I wouldn't know that. But a lot of people that I have talked to since I've read the book also didn't know that.
No, you'd have to be a good 80, 90 years old to remember the pond. In the valley of Skull Creek, where Wilson Park is now, a man named A.L. Trent started building sort of a tourist park. And as part of that, he built a dam around the spring that's there. The spring still comes out right next to the Wilson Park Castle. And that spring fed this pond. And it was a very popular place in the 19-teens and the 20s. To go swimming. They had a slide. They had a gazebo for a band. So it was a very popular place during the summer. But in the late 1920s, they decided to build a big concrete pool that is still there, has been remodeled and rehabbed several times. But once they built the new swimming pool, they went ahead and drained the pond, and it's now a softball field. And the pond was known as Trent's Pond since he informally known as Trent's Pond.
Which are your absolute favorites in the book, the pictures, images of Fayetteville?
One I remember is a photo that we sort of got late in the process. There was a collection of photographs by a photographer named Bennett. I don't remember his first name at the moment, but one was this beautiful nighttime photo looking down Center Street toward the square. Lights all aglow, and you know, it looked to me like some kind of Broadway kind of photo. I think all of us, when we saw it, was like, oh, yeah.
Well, I was partial to the 1940s, I guess, because I was a child then myself. So there is a picture in the People section of the Pigeon Club, the young people who lived along Washington Street, Washington Avenue, I think, for the most part. But they had this pigeon club, and they're standing there. They're so proud. And these just tell you so much about how people were actually living, daily living. And I'm always drawn to photographs like that.
When you're writing the book, especially a pictorial history book, is it hard to not compare the past and the present?
Visual history is just a layered experience. It's one of my pleasures in life to know what was there, when, and how it's changed. And maybe I don't like the way it's changed, but nonetheless, I have a deep sense of layering.
It's funny growing up in Fayetteville and staying here when I grew up during the 60s and 70s and got out of college in the early 80s. And most of my friends, close friends, left here and went to Dallas, went to Kansas City, went to big markets to work. And somehow I stayed. And sooner or later, somebody asked me, well, you know, what's it like to live in the same town all your life? And my response is that it's not the same town. It changes so rapidly that, you know, if it were the same town, I would probably be bored to death. But but it has. It's continued to change. And some of that is really good. Somehow you have to weigh those two things and decide which is better and which is worse.
Is there a book signing, book event coming up?
There will be several events coming up. Probably the first thing on our schedule, the Washington County Historical Society has its annual ice cream social on the third Saturday of the month. So come by, and we'll be signing books at it.
August 20th.
August 20th. We're also planning to do, the Historical Society has a lecture series going on, and so we'll do one of the lectures in October. We hope people will come to that. It's going to be at the Bank of Fayetteville, and then we'll do a walking tour around the square. The book is available at, I think, at all of the bookstores. I don't know if it's actually on the shelves yet, but we'll be at all of the bookstores locally, Nightbird and Barnes & Noble and Hastings. I think it's going to be up at the University Bookstore as well, and Collier's and places like that. So look for it. All the proceeds go to the Washington County Historical, or I shouldn't say all, but the profits anyway go to the Washington County Historical Society.
Thank you so much, Charlie and Ellen.
Okay.
Well, you're very welcome, Ethy. Thank you very much.
That conversation about a book about Fayetteville history first aired earlier this year on Ozarks at Large in 2011. We're doing some of our favorite stories all this week on Ozarks at Large. This was a particularly interesting year when you think about it. Tornadoes, floods, record snowfall, record cold, record heat. And all in the middle of that, Jackie, a visit by the Dalai Lama to Fayetteville.
But rumors had been circulating for like 2 years in
Buddhist
communities that he was coming. And everyone was disregarding these rumors. Turns out, university hosts a big reveal a year before, preceding the visit, saying, in fact, the Dalai Lama was coming. And how it worked out is it was due to Dr. Sidney Burris, mm-hmm. who's director of the Fulbright College of Honors Program, and his cohort, Geshe Dorje. Mm-hmm. I hope I'm saying that right. Right, Geshe Dorje. He's a highly initiated Tibetan monk who's an instructor here at the University of Arkansas. And together, they put together the Tibetan Cultural Institute of Arkansas. And they've traveled to Tibet. They've met the Dalai Lama with students in tow that were doing some oral history project work and research. And it was around that time where they asked the Dalai Lama to come to Arkansas. They didn't ever think he would bite. But then they got the email saying, is invitation still open? Can we come?
And what do you say to that? Well, yes. Absolutely, yes.
So the Distinguished Lectures Committee brought the Dalai Lama in, huge crowds, everyone very excited, the whole town, the whole region, states, surrounding states turned out, and proceeds from ticket sales were donated to local charities, which was really cool.
Well, here is Jackie's coverage of the Dalai Lama's visit to Fayetteville in Northwest Arkansas earlier this year.
More than 10,000 people jammed Bud Walton Arena at the University of Arkansas Wednesday afternoon to hear His Holiness the Dalai Lama deliver an address, Nonviolence in the New Century, the Way Forward. His visit, sponsored by the university's Distinguished Lecture Series, was the result of an invitation by Sidney Burris, director of the Fulbright College Honors Program, and colleague Geshe Dorje, Tibetan monk and U of A instructor. They're founders of the Tibetan Cultural Institute of Arkansas. A week of Tibetan lectures, art, and sacred music led up to the Dalai Lama's appearance, and preceding his lecture, University of Arkansas Chancellor David Gearhart conferred an honorary degree of Doctor of Humane Letters. He opened his talk by clarifying misconceptions about himself and his country.
Then some people say, oh, that land, that country, rather sort of mysterious land. And even some book about Tibet, they call Third Eye. So Tibetan people have some kind of magical power like that. These are nonsense. Yeah. And then me personally, some people call me God King, Living Buddha. That also nonsense. Then some people call me demon. That also nonsense. What is a real person? I usually describe myself as a simple Buddhist monk.
He says he's the same as all people on earth. We wish to be happy.
I always see telling, sharing with people in order to be happy life. We should pay more attention about our inner value. Try to seek happy life from external, from money, from power. It's a mistake. Yes, money important. All these, no doubt, very important. But ultimate source of happiness is within ourselves. There are no differences, whether educated or uneducated, rich or poor, or high sort of status or low status, or different color, or even believer or non-believer, no differences. That is, to believer, faith, tremendous faith to God, according to his religion, that also immense source of inner peace, inner strength.
The Dalai Lama says Tibetan Buddhism is rooted in academic inquiry. He himself has an abiding interest in world events, and especially in science. He says research shows happiness begins in the womb, that a mother's mental state affects her unborn child, and once born, those who receive physical affection grow up to be calm and less fearful. He recalled his own mother's love as a little boy on the family's farm, riding on her shoulders, steering her this way and that by holding onto her ears. The audience loved it. He says we are all bound by human affection, not by religion or even education. He says all this because he believes in an emerging new world order led by young people nurtured to be compassionate and nonviolent.
When people, you see, sort of almost now use a new slogan, peace, world peace, world peace. Just that word will not bring peace. Or through prayer also will not bring peace. Peace. And meditation, through meditation, bring world peace. No. World peace, firstly, war, human action, human creation. So peace also, we human beings themselves must create. Through our action, peace will come. Peace does not mean no longer any sort of disagreement. No longer any problem. Problem remain there. I jokingly telling people, if we really want peaceful world, no longer any problem, then either human species disappear or our brain change. So that's not good. In any way, we can't do that. I think human brain, one way, real troublemaker, but one way, human intelligence, because of human intelligence, we human being, only human being, can develop infinite love, infinite altruism. No other animal. Biologically, difficult. But as a seed of the compassion from biological factor, then use human intelligence. Through that way, we can develop infinite love and compassion.
The Dalai Lama says we must teach children the art of dialogue and instill self-confidence and warm-heartedness. And secularism, by definition.
Secularism is respect all religion, no preference this religion or that religion. And according to Indian sort of secularism sort of idea, even respect non-believer.
The Dalai Lama is ecumenical and does not proselytize. His given name is Tenzin Gyatso. He was born in 1935 in northeastern Tibet. At the age of two, he was recognized as the reincarnation of the 13th Dalai Lama, a tradition which spans six centuries. Dalai Lamas are believed to be manifestations of the Bodhisattva, enlightened beings who postpone their own nirvana, a sort of heaven, and choose to take rebirth in order to serve humanity. He was forced to leave Tibet after the Chinese invasion and occupation during the 1950s. He escaped to northern India, where he established a Tibetan government in exile in Dharamsala. Although the Chinese claim it was a peaceful liberation, Tibet claims up to 500,000 people died in their struggle for political sovereignty. The Chinese government today counts nearly 3 million Tibetans in the so-called Autonomous Tibet region. China has 1.3 billion people. An estimated 10,000 Tibetans in exile live in the United States, and a census in Dharamsala is being conducted this year by the Indian government. The Dalai Lama, who travels the globe, has led the Tibetan government in exile from Dharamsala. He was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize for his nonviolent struggle for the people of Tibet in 1989, and in 2007, the Congressional Gold Medal by President George W. Bush. After his lecture at Bud Walton Arena, he took several questions submitted via email, like how does he feel his absence from Tibet has affected young Tibetans, and what would happen if he returned?
Oh, there's a Tibetan saying, Lame chenlu jangne chesere.
There's a Tibetan expression which says that the blessings of a lama is better from a distance.
Of course, see, Tibetan people inside Tibet are very, very eager. It's my return. And they want, before they die, they want to see. I sort of received a lot of sort of moving message from Tibet. And then meantime, those more sort of, because of the intelligent people, they expressed to me, they sent message to me, it is sufficient for them, Dalai Lama, alive, freely. So they appreciate my presence in free world, they feel then Dalai Lama can represent of them.
On the Arab Spring political movement question, he said the world belongs to humanity and not government, and that he appreciates American informality and freedom. He also described the role of media as being like an elephant's trunk. It ought to probe every possible place in order to reveal the truth. And when asked how we can, as regular people, attain peace?
I think, of course, I'm monk, celibate. No problem about family or children or these things. But equally, I have a lot of problems. But when problems start, when problems face, some disturbance in my mind, but then gone. Then on the surface, usually I describe like ocean. On the surface, wave comes and goes, but underneath, always calm. That we can do with help of intelligence. What's the inner strength? These two combined, you can maintain inner peace, no matter what surrounding.
The Dalai Lama recently handed over political control of his government in exile with the election of Harvard legal scholar Lobsang Senge as new prime minister. The Dalai Lama recently handed over political control of his government in exile with the election of Harvard legal scholar Lobsang Senge as new prime minister. He said it was time to return solely to spiritual rule as prescribed by the first four Dalai Lamas. And he told his faithful audience he plans to spend the rest of his life promoting human values and religious harmony.
The Dalai Lama's visit to Northwest Arkansas earlier this year. I remember, Jackie, obviously you were there. Antoinette, you were there.
I was in India.
That's a pretty good excuse. I remember driving toward Barn Hill, I think, to pick you up so you could produce a story. And it is the most diverse group of people exiting an event I've ever seen, as far as age, as far as appearance, as far anything. I mean, you just couldn't. If you didn't know what was going on, you'd say, what was that? Because everybody seemed to be there.
There were a lot of people, and like you said, just really diverse crowd. It was pretty cool.
It was. You did a story this year, which you were excited to do the story. I think, Antoinette, one reason you were excited is because didn't you get to wear scrubs?
I so got to wear scrubs. I was ready to fight people for this story when you mentioned it. At Mercy Medical Center in Rogers, they had this program where they were taking kids from the Boys and Girls Club. And they got to go into a locker room and put on scrubs and, you know, put on the hairnets and whatnot and scrub in. And they got to go into a real surgical suite and kind of learn the different roles that doctors and nurses play. And they invited the media, and so all of us got to go. Like, so it was me and a couple of camera people and a reporter from the paper. And so, I mean, the first thing they do, they're like, okay, well, you're going to take off your clothes and put these on. And we're like, okay. So we got to wear scrubs, and you had to pull her hair back, and I had to be careful with my equipment, had to sterilize all of that to go into the surgical suite. But it was so cool because we were just sat back and observed the kids. And, you know, one of the first, they had these two nurses in there, and they were like, who wants to be this role? Who wants to be this role? And so they taught them the different things. You know, this person is responsible for counting all of the items, basically making sure they don't leave a sponge in someone, you know, and this is for this and this is for that. And some of them got to practice suturing on a banana and cauterizing. So that was cool. And then in the other room, they were learning how to use a particular sort of instrument if you were doing surgery. So they were trying to pick up like a piece of gum and stick it on a box just using this camera. And it was a lot more difficult, but by far one of my favorite stories from the year.
Well, let's listen to you go in your scrubs into the, was it the OR?
Yeah.
An OR?
Okay. Yeah, we had to move at one point because they were wheeling someone in.
Oh.
Who wants to volunteer to be a patient? Okay. You be my patient. You're going to hop up on the table.
Yeah, jobs.
Pam David is a certified registered nurse first assistant at Mercy Medical Center in Rogers. She's talking to a group of teenagers who toured the hospital's surgical suites last week. The students were members of the Keystone Club, a character and leadership group at the Boys and Girls Club. In addition to a patient, participants were also able to choose other roles such as a doctor, CRNA, or CST, and were taught more about those professions. Cindy Menjivar, Special Projects Coordinator at the Boys and Girls Club of Benton County, says all of the visiting students are interested in the medical field.
I think it's important just so they can see that it's something that, like, it's an attainable goal. You know, I don't want them to think, you know, nursing school is super hard. It's very competitive because I think all of them can make it in the medical field. So I want them to really think about it and, you know, experience, get a little taste of everything.
Menjivar says they help Keystone Club members focus on school by taking them on college tours and hosting guest speakers. She says when this opportunity presented itself, they snagged it.
One of our Keystone members from the Bentonville unit, her mom is a staff here, and the first we started, we got a tour of the whole facility. We got to go and look at the lab, and they got to see, like, samples and blood cells and all that kind of stuff. And then she actually approached me about, you know, possibly bringing them in and scrubbing in, and the kids were super excited about it, especially with, you know, a lot of them being seniors. They're thinking about college and nursing school and all that kind of stuff.
This is real surgery, Pam. What we do is before we say, hi, my name's Carol. I'm going to be your nurse today. Can you tell me your name and date of birth?
Carol Piakowski, director of surgery, also spoke to the teens. Participants learned about the various tasks that must be accomplished prior to and during surgery. They were also given a summary of the amount of education required for different medical field positions. Before entering the operating room, the teenagers donned scrubs and surgical caps. Piakowski says the benefit of these types of visits is giving participants a hands-on experience.
Kids who are interested in a medical career, they can read about it, they can YouTube, they can see the video, but they can't get hands-on any other way. And so to see what we really do and to see how things work in here, they have to come in and actually do it here. So it's just fun for them.
The students' hands-on experience included learning how to properly scrub in.
You're going to wet your brush, get some soap on it, and then you're going to start with your palms of your hands, getting the soap, and then you're going to do your nails about 20 times, and then you're going to do each, like, this side of this finger 10 times, this side of this finger 10 times, this side of this finger 10 times, and you go through each finger.
Four sides, this is called an anatomical scrub.
Next, they return to the OR and don their surgical gowns.
See these two folds? Those are going to be where your arms are going to go. So you're going to dive into your gown.
Whoa. Pull back. Good job.
After that, they split into two groups. The first group practiced cauterizing a banana.
We were using bananas as our patient and taking, the kids would take an electrocautery, and that uses radio frequency current that would open the banana skin with the electrocautery, and then we had them suture with a suture and close the skin back up so they could get a feel for what it's like. Well, not quite the same, but to open and close patients.
Piakowski took the students step by step through the suturing process and offered words of encouragement to the surgical novices.
Your right hand.
Okay, you're going to hold it like this. Okay?
Put fingers.
Okay? Okay. Now, this is your cut, right? So, oh, look at that instinct. She grabbed it with the pickups just the way she's supposed to. Isn't that awesome? Okay, so you're going to go through that end and the other. Perfect. Now.
Across the hall in another OR, the second group of teenagers learned about laparoscopy, a group of operations performed with the aid of a camera in the abdomen or pelvis. The laparoscope allows doctors to perform surgery in a minimally invasive manner. One student had to guide a camera around a black box full of sticks of gum and pieces of candy. While looking at the screens overhead, the other student used a grasping instrument to pick up the stick of gum and place it on top of a platform inside the box. They quickly discovered that task was a little more complex than it seemed.
Okay, now the platform's over here.
Now, so electric current,
there you go.
When it goes in, it will tiny tip, it will burn. This is real
science.
One of the visiting Keystone members was 17-year-old Tanya Perez. The recent Rogers High School graduate has been interested in the medical field from a young age and has plans to become a registered nurse.
The schooling, you know, it takes a while and it's really competitive, but I'm sure in the end it'll be enjoyable to do, really fun, and you just get to go home with that feeling that you actually made a difference on an everyday basis.
Although the Keystone Club members were only at the hospital for a few hours, the visit confirmed Perez's desire to pursue a nursing career.
It's just the whole experience, just the fact that the hospital is letting us do this. I mean, it's pretty neat. It's really making me push forward on becoming a nurse. It just seems really fun and exciting.
For Ozarks at Large, I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
This is Ozarks at Large, in addition, where we're hearing some of our favorite stories that we did in 2011. I went to Siloam Springs. It was shortly after school had started, public schools, and there was an initiative at Siloam Springs. It was a combination between the Northwest Arkansas Council, Siloam Springs Public Schools, John Brown University, and I may be forgetting one other entity, Siloam Chamber of Commerce.
Yes.
And they went together. They were trying to get recent students who had left school, mm-hmm. decided not to continue toward their public school degree, and bring them back and try to encourage them. And so they met on a Saturday morning. They were going to go out, and this is what happened. Saturday morning, Michelle Markovich, the principal at Main Street Academy, an alternative public school in Siloam Springs, was up early and at work, arranging chairs. An hour later, about 24 people would be there to begin a day participants hoped would bring some former students back to school. The program, called Reach Out Siloam Springs, sent 3-person teams to homes of students who've left school. The goal was to convince the students to come back and earn their diploma. Michelle Markovich says the project is the result of a whirlwind of 6 weeks of preparation.
Anytime we've talked about what we're doing today, going to the homes of kids who haven't shown back up to school to try to find out what we can do to get them to come back to school, people have said, what can I do to help? What are you guys doing? What do you need? So it's really a neat thing to see the people in the community do care about all students in the school district.
Reach Out Siloam Springs is a collaboration between the Siloam Springs School District, the city's Chamber of Commerce, the Northwest Arkansas Council, and John Brown University. Students who have left public school were identified, and efforts to contact them were made. This Saturday was intended as a follow-up, or, if that initial contact hadn't been successful, a first chance to find out why the students had left school. Kim Davis with the Northwest Arkansas Council helped coordinate the day.
We sort of have a door hang as well. If we go out and students aren't home, we say, hey, we really miss you. We came by. Sorry we didn't see you today. But here's some contact information that can be used to enroll back in school. We're sending folks out with enrollment papers as well as sort of a script that sort of goes through exactly the type of information we want to need to make sure we're tracking our kids. So
Saturday's concentrated effort to bring back students to a public school setting, in this case Main Street Academy in downtown Siloam Springs, is the first of its kind in Arkansas. The idea was pioneered in Houston, where results have been encouraging. The Siloam Springs effort was one of 21 different such activities around the country this weekend. And Kim Davis says the desire is to spread the Reach Out project throughout Northwest Arkansas as soon as next year. Davis says the message is simple. The school district genuinely wants you back.
The training is about showing how much you care. And that's really what it is. It's an effort on behalf of the community to say, you are not forgotten. We care about you. We care about your future, and we want you here. And we're going to help you deal with all of those things. If there is a child care issue, we're prepared to answer how to go about solving that issue. If there is a language issue or a language barrier, if there's a health issue there, maybe with a parent and the student's unable to come because they're attending to their parents' needs. You know, all of those questions, the community has stepped up and said, let us help you with that. We think we can solve those problems. We think we can find the answers to those problems. So let us help you and let's get you back in school because we understand the impact it'll have on your future and your children's futures down the road.
Kim Davis says Siloam Springs seemed like the perfect district for the pilot Reach Out Day in Northwest Arkansas. It's large enough to be able to identify about 20 students who've quit school, but not so large that the first attempt would require a large squadron of volunteers.
Well, I want to thank everyone for coming out this morning on what I think is a pretty exciting day. We all know why we're here.
By 9 o'clock, an eager batch of educators, community members, and students from JBU have gathered for a donated breakfast and to go over last-minute instructions. Each team will carry information about the value of a high school graduation, and each will be equipped with a city map. Michelle Markovich, the principal at Main Street Academy, says while the entirety of the program includes the community, today's first step is primarily staffed by educators.
We did try to keep this mainly educators right now because a lot of these students that we're going to be visiting have already been in the school district. And we want to send someone to their home who has a relationship with the student and can offer encouragement in that way. The way that the community will become more involved is afterwards when we find out, oh, we have a family who is in need of child care and hooking them up with services through the Child Development Center to provide daycare, or maybe families in need of other resources, medical, Ozark guidance, food, and we can use the community to help supply those resources once we know what the needs are.
John Brown, who chairs the particular education task force that was spawned from the Northwest Arkansas Council overseeing this project, says community help with the program can come in many forms, including a supportive attitude towards students who may be working at a local business to help a family earn enough money for food or shelter.
A lot of these kids are working part-time, maybe because it's a necessity with their family situation. And we want employers to tell their part-time student employees, you need to stay in school. You know, this paycheck will help you, but I'll rearrange your hours, I'll do whatever I can, but it's important to me as an employer that you stay in school. So we see it as an ongoing emphasis, but this is just kind of the most visible part.
Each of the teams meeting with students includes a Walton Scholar from John Brown University, young people from South America who've earned a scholarship to attend JBU. Francis Morales and Max Rodriguez took a moment between eating donated cinnamon rolls to explain why they sacrificed a weekend day of the fall semester to try to convince people they don't know to go back to school.
Like, education for me is really important, and if I have the chance to encourage some other guys to do this and to share my experience with education, I will do it. Yeah, and it's really worth it. And I don't mind waking up early because this is really worth it.
Just thankfulness and just giving back a little bit of what we've been giving. And we have this awesome Fulbright scholarship, and I feel like it's just part of our blessing is to give back to, and especially to the community we're in.
The hope is that a small team with a 20-something representative, relatively fresh out of high school, can help ease any tension there might be when two older adults also show up to ask about returning to school. And connecting more young Arkansans to high school diplomas is a top objective in the state, from the governor's mansion to the Northwest Arkansas Council. In fact, several months ago, when the Northwest Arkansas Council released a report on the strengths and weaknesses of the region, raising the number of residents with high school and college diplomas was a top goal, along with improvements to infrastructure and public transportation. But while it's easy to count the number of miles of improved roads or the number of bus routes that have been added, calculating a better educated region is harder to gauge. John Brown says when he talked with members of the Northwest Arkansas Council, he wanted to be sure there was the understanding that improvements in education would take time.
And I said, are they with us for the long run? Because this isn't the kind of project where in 6 months we're going to change graduation rates or something. You have to be there for the long term. And the schools have to feel that as well, that we're here to come alongside. The council's not trying to tell schools how to educate kids or just, you know, hold up a red flag or something and wave it at them. We're trying to come alongside and encourage them in ways that are appropriate as a council. And so we have a variety of ideas of what might work in that regard. And this is one.
Whether one or as many as a dozen students come back to school as a result of the visit Saturday, organizers think the creation of the pilot program is already a success, providing a concentration on the value of education on many aspects of the region. Kim Davis with the Northwest Arkansas Council says Saturday's work was a step in the right direction.
But all those things are important to the council as we sort of move forward, that we begin to pull in our business leaders, our community leaders, our educational leaders to begin to create the type of Northwest Arkansas where we know business, companies, families, young folks, the community that we know folks would want to move in.
Full results of Saturday's appeals may not be tabulated for some time, depending on how many students return to class in Siloam Springs. But organizers plan to expand the Reach Out program to other schools next year. That story first aired in September of this year. Today, tomorrow, and Friday, we'll continue some of our favorite stories from 2011. Jacqueline Froelich, how are you?
I'm good. I'm thinking about Christmas cookies, actually.
Did you have some this Christmas?
Not enough.
Okay, well, I'm going to ask you a question that'll get your mind off that. If you could pick one person who's living that you could interview, and I know I'm just throwing this at you, who would it be? Well, you have a pained look on your
Chomsky.
Face.
Noam Chomsky.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm.
Katie?
He's a linguist.
One
person? Yeah, one person?
Oh, dear.
Oh, goodness. One person. I'm blanking out. I'm not very good at picking
We'll come back to you. Ithi, do you have someone?
I just interview everyone.
Which is the opposite of just one person, but we'll let that answer go.
Because everyone is one person, and everyone has a good story to tell. So,
nice answer.
Yeah, nice answer.
I like that. I like her answer, too. Feeling on the spot. The Queen?
Oh, yeah. What would you ask her?
Which queen? The Queen of England.
That's interesting. She's seen a lot, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. All right, she just popped into my head for some reason.
Living, you say?
Yes.
Probably you. Seriously, because you interview a lot of people, and I think it would be really interesting to talk to you as an interviewee, and maybe even talk to you about all the people that you've talked to. For me, it would be interesting.
Okay.
Oh, what a great idea. When are we going to do this?
Let's do it now.
We should do it.
Well, we don't have time.
Okay, well, next week, maybe.
I think I would like to talk to Kris Kristofferson. You know, he was a Golden Gloves boxer. He's in the Songwriters Hall of Fame. He's been an actor. He made out with Jane Fonda on screen. I mean, there's a lot of things to ask him about. So, that's it. All right, tomorrow more?
Sure.
All right, thanks.
Thanks.
Welcome.
I have seen the morning burning golden on the mountain in the skies. Aching with the feeling of the freedom of an eagle when she flies. Turning on the world the way she smiled upon my soul as I lay dying. Healing as the colors and the sunshine and the shadows of...
If you're keeping track at home, that's from Kris Kristofferson's great album, The Silver Tongue, Devil and I. Ozarks at Large is supported by the Center for Arkansas and Regional Studies at the University of Arkansas in Fayetteville, dedicated to the celebration and documentation of the region's history and culture. From coverage of the Arab Spring to the drawdown of American troops in Iraq, KUAF has kept you informed on the most important events of 2011. The news will not let up in 2012. There's a presidential campaign, plus continued debates in Congress over a variety of issues. You can help us bring that news to you. You can make a year-end tax-deductible gift at KUAF.com. That's KUAF.com. Click on Contribute Now, and thank you. This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Rogers, Springdale, a listener-supported service of the Department of Journalism and Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. KUAF has proudly served as your source for NPR programming for the past 26 years. You can listen online at our website, KUAF.com. More of our favorite stories on tomorrow's edition of Ozarks at Large, including a tour of the Daisy Manufacturing Plant in Rogers and how the city of Harrison is dealing with its racial past. Those stories, two of our favorites, and others, tomorrow on a Thursday edition of Ozarks at Large.
She ain't ashamed to be a woman nor afraid to be a friend. I don't know the answer to the easy way she opened every door in my mind. But dreaming was as easy as believing it was never gonna end. And loving her was easier than anything I